This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The best ice scientists in the world just issued this stark warning. 2 degrees of warming commits all future generations to shrinking land and a deader ocean. The melting temperature of water is not open to negotiation. The ice world breaks down well before 2 degrees C of warming, and we are heading towards 3 degrees or more on our current course. 2 degrees is too high, says the new State of the Cryosphere 2023 report. Joining us is scientist Twyla Moon. Dr. Moon is deputy lead scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado. From Boulder, Colorado, Twyla Moon, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So the cryosphere is wherever snow or ice appear, and that's about 10% of the land surface of the planet, plus some of the sea surface that's frozen over with sea ice. How did this frozen world react to record-breaking heat in recent years?
Unfortunately, as you might imagine, the Earth's frozen components, so we're talking about snow, ice that forms on the ocean as sea ice, land ice that forms glaciers, so the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets, and also frozen ground or permafrost. And all of these elements are extremely sensitive to small changes in temperature, just as the ice in your freezer is. And these warming temperatures have been producing rapid and really somewhat devastating effects for these frozen components of the Earth system.
For a long time, scientists knew climate tipping points existed, but could not say when or what warming would trigger them. It sounds like there's more certainty now for tipping points in the cryosphere. Tell us more.
Scientists have been continuing to improve our understandings of the Earth system and the processes at play, including improving our understanding of these frozen parts of our Earth system. And we often don't, as scientists, necessarily talk about tipping points as much as somewhat thresholds. I think sometimes folks with a word like tipping point can get an idea that things are going along fine and then suddenly fall off the end of a cliff. Unfortunately, things are not going along fine for the cryosphere right now, and those impacts are going to worsen into the future. What we do start to understand are these thresholds in which we start to have more irreversible damages. And those might be changes that would require many thousands of years for us to see, for example, regrowth of glaciers, or to have the possibility of slowing and beginning to again freeze ground as permafrost. So as we're understanding how these frozen parts of the Earth system work, we are being able to hone in more closely on what should be some of our global temperature goals in order to protect these systems.
And one of those may be the West Antarctic ice sheet. There's a suggestion in the report that we've already passed that and that will be lost.
Yes, there are several instances where we have already begun what could be irreversible losses. The West Antarctic ice sheet is a good example. And that, of course, is related to sea level rise that's showing up on coasts around the world. But even when we have components like ice sheet melt that contribute to sea level rise, we know now, even with very low emission scenarios, we are likely to see a continued uptick of sea level. However, for us as humans, as communities, as economies to adapt, the rate of that change is really important. And that's where we can still see a lot of influence of human action. So if we are undertaking strong action and following some of the lowest emission pathways, we see a substantial decrease in the speed at which oceans are rising and the total amount of additional ocean rise that different coasts will see. And that, of course, is really important because that would mean we have more time to adapt and might not see the scale of changes that we would see if we were to continue on our current pathway of emissions.
Well, another threshold in the report concerns what happens to the oceans when CO2 goes higher than 450 parts per million. We're currently crossing around 424 parts per million in November of 2023, and that's 50% higher than pre-industrial times already, and it's increasing at a faster rate. What does happen in the ocean at that 450 parts per million rate?
You're correct. I think sometimes folks forget that as we put carbon dioxide into our atmosphere, the ocean does important work taking up that carbon dioxide, which helps to keep it outside of the atmosphere and not produce as much warm temperatures. However, when the ocean is taking up carbon dioxide, that results in ocean acidification. And a more acidic ocean is a problem for those small species, many of them at the base of the food pyramid, that need not as acidic conditions in order to build the shells and essentially kind of their structures of life. And we see that already polar oceans in the Arctic and the Antarctic are taking up carbon dioxide more rapidly than other oceans around the world. And so they are seeing fairly rapid ocean acidification. And we can already observe that there are species that are seeing damage to their shells and body structure because of this increased acidification in the ocean. So that's something we have to be very concerned about in regards to continued emissions into the future. And ocean acidification is a process that is another one of these that is not reversible, except for over many thousands of years.
The big producers of coal, oil, and gas are developing more fossil fuels, enough to take us to 3 degrees warming and beyond. But let's hope for a miracle. Somehow the global average temperatures are only 2 degrees C over pre-industrial by 2100. Is that good? Is that safe? What happens at 2 degrees of warming?
2 degrees of warming is certainly better than 3 degrees of warming. But unfortunately, even at 2 degrees of warming, we see some very significant and irreversible influences for the cryosphere. So first, I think it's important for listeners to remember that that global average temperature we talk about is just that, a global average. And actual temperature increases in different places in the globe can be higher or lower. Unfortunately, the Arctic is one of the fastest warming parts of our planet. It's warming several times faster than that global average. So if we were to limit global average to 2 degrees Celsius, we will be seeing higher temperatures in the Arctic. And all of the components of the cryosphere are highly sensitive to that temperature change. So as we are getting to 2 degrees, if we were to be limiting ourselves to 2 degrees, we would, at that temperature, be seeing a substantial loss and total loss of some glaciers around the world, certainly tropical and low-latitude glaciers. We'd also be committing ourselves to substantial long-term sea level rise, ongoing thawing of permafrost. This is important in part because as we thaw that frozen ground and permafrost, it releases additional heat-trapping gases to the atmosphere, which we will have to deal with as well as what we humans are putting into the atmosphere. So 2 degrees, as I said, certainly better than limiting to higher temperatures, but at that 2 degrees, we would be seeing some very significant and devastating impacts for communities and people around the world.
Based on detailed studies of markers from the past, ice can melt much faster than it is formed. What does that tell us about the way this planet changes from an ice house to hothouse climates?
Yes, it's a really important observation that we are not able to grow, for example, a Greenland ice sheet as quickly as it might be able to disappear. In the past, the Earth's changes, which of course have the Earth in the past, has seen temperatures much higher than today, and it's also seen temperatures much lower than today. Of course, humans were not around at those times. We weren't trying to maintain a civilization and have agriculture and stable communities and infrastructure. So as the Earth changed in the past, there was simply a longer period of time of moving into or out of an ice age. And what we are doing today is we people are significantly increasing the pace of this change in our atmosphere, adding heat-trapping gases, and that's producing very rapid responses, for example, from ice sheets. Unfortunately, if we were to stop our warming now and achieve, for example, a limit at 1.5 degrees, that doesn't mean that we're getting to yet grow back glaciers and ice sheets. It would simply be a reduction of loss into the future. It takes much colder temperatures to start to build the ice because it's something that is built through snow year after year after year.
We could spend a whole interview on each chapter in the Cryosphere Report. It covers ice sheets and sea level, mountain glaciers, permafrost, sea ice, and ocean acidification. Let's go back to the permafrost. Could you give us a snapshot of the current situation, and are there danger points approaching there?
Yes, so permafrost is frozen ground. Actually, about a quarter of the northern hemisphere is underlain by permafrost. I think some folks are surprised to learn that. And as permafrost is exposed to warming air temperatures, those temperatures in the air can start to move down into the ground and warm the ground and thaw the permafrost. You can almost imagine taking a frozen chicken, out of your freezer and setting it on the counter. As it thaws, it doesn't become a puddle of water. Rather, you're left with the chicken. So that's the process of thaw, of frozen ground. And just like as you're taking that chicken out of the freezer, when it was frozen, you could not worry about eating it for months. But once it's thawed out on the counter, microbial activity is getting started, and you better eat that chicken pretty fast. Well, with frozen ground, as it's thawing, that's also allowing microbial and activity to happen and starting to release heat-trapping gases. So folks who are living in places with permafrost are concerned about thaw because it can cause potholes to open up in the ground or uneven patterns that can get in the way of roads working properly or cause damage to buildings. And people who are far away from permafrost should be very concerned about these additional heat-trapping gases that get released into the atmosphere. And that is a process that is quite slow for reversing. So that is, as we stabilize temperatures in our atmosphere, or I hope we stabilize temperatures in our atmosphere, the permafrost is a bit slower to respond to that and is likely to continue to add heat-trapping gases to our atmosphere for 100 or 200 years that we'll have to be continuing to offset through our human actions.
What are the concerns about rain over Greenland?
Yes, we have seen increased amounts of rain over Greenland, and then we've also seen a lengthening summer melt season. Sometimes I think folks are surprised to realize that rain can be especially problematic for the ice sheet, because not only is that rain falling and not adding extra massive snow, but that rain water is a little bit warmer than the ice that it falls onto and can encourage additional melt. We can also have instances where if we see melt on the surface of the ice sheet, but deep into the interior, that surface melt might trickle down into the ice sheet surface layer some and then freeze again, forming an ice lens that makes it harder for future melt to get caught up in the ice sheet and freeze again, causing that melt instead to go ahead and run off into the ocean, adding to sea level rise. So we've been seeing additional rain, and we've also been seeing some remarkable warm events in Greenland. For example, September of last year, 2022, we saw melt events on the surface of the ice sheet late into September, a time when we would normally be expecting just to be having snow and a buildup of snow and ice mass on the ice sheet.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more
on the blog, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is scientist Twyla Moon from the National Snow and Ice Data Center. We're talking about the State of the Cryosphere 2023 report, 2 degrees is too high. That comes from the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative, a cooperative among the world's best ice and snow experts. Ice experts have one of the longest takes on climate change. You look back hundreds of thousands of years and forward thousands of years, and the long view is even more scary in a way. The public seems unaware of these dangers because they happen in faraway places often. What are the predictions on our current course for sea level rise from ice loss?
Our current course suggests that we might see very high levels of sea level rise. We're currently on course to a 3 degrees Celsius warming by 2100, and that opens the possibility for us to be moving to more than 1 meter of sea level rise average over these next 80 years. Now, when it comes to sea level rise, there are some important processes that we haven't been able to observe directly because, of course, humans have never undertaken this experiment before. We've never existed in a time with such high global temperatures as we see now or that we're headed towards. And so there are some processes about how ice sheets move and lose ice that we're not yet sure how quickly they are able to respond. The concern is that they may be able to respond more quickly than we have earlier imagined, and that opens up the possibility of committing ourselves to multiple, 10-plus meters of sea level rise over the next couple hundreds of years. Of course, that doesn't come all at once. That means ongoing rapid sea level rise that may uptick into the future here and cause a lot of issues with us being able to adapt and adjust our civilizations because we have many megacities, shipping infrastructure, a lot of coastal activity that we have on the planet now. And of course, we'd like to be able to keep that or at least be able to have sea levels rising slow enough that we can adapt to the change.
Is it possible we could see shocking sea level rise? I mean, there have been pulses in the past, meltwater pulses up to 4 meters or 13 feet. Might it happen again?
It is possible that we could see some very large sea level increases, particularly as we look past the next 80 years and into the 2100s. That's a period where we could see a stark increase in rates of sea level rise beyond what we've experienced in this point or expect in the next few decades. And I sometimes am reminded to think like folks who have existed in these places for millennia, thinking about Arctic indigenous residents who will often talk about timescales of 7 or more generations or multiple thousands of years. They, of course, maintained their societies on these long timescales. So sometimes it can sound like 80 years is very, very far away from now. But in fact, it's just around the corner. And a child born today will be influenced by those events in 80 years.
Can you pick out one more important story from the report, perhaps something you consider underreported or underestimated?
I often think that folks don't fully appreciate the important services that are being provided by mountain glaciers and snow. We talk more about sea level rise or thinking about, for example, additional heat-trapping gases from thawing permafrost. But many people don't realize that glaciers all around the world, from the Himalaya to the Andes to the Alps, are providing drinking water, providing agricultural water, providing runoff that is powering hydropower stations, and as well as providing tourism and other local infrastructure. Unfortunately, these mountain glaciers are really in serious trouble. And we could see the total loss of quite a few of them just at 2 degrees warming. And that means drinking water, agricultural water, and power problems for millions of people around the world. And I think that folks often underappreciate how important these smaller glaciers and that seasonal snowpack is for being able to have our water needs met throughout the year.
This report says only 1.5 degrees C will save the ice world and the ways that it currently shapes our climate. Former NASA scientist James Hansen says 1.5 is deader than a doornail. He's all about Earth energy imbalance and watts per meter squared and changes in Earth's reflectivity called albedo. Reading the report, I could not find the word albedo or any discussion of it, even when Antarctic sea ice is almost gone. Did I miss something, or is that for next year?
Albedo was not a primary topic of this report, although that you're correct that it is an important topic. As we're losing highly reflective, bright sea ice, we're exposing a dark ocean surface that is better at taking up heat and energy from the sun, and then causing further warming. So you're correct that albedo changes are an important topic area, and they can produce what I call vicious amplifying cycles, where we get a process underway and that process starts to grow on its own, even if we might work later to dampen it. And I can appreciate where he's coming from in the sense that we are very, very close to this 1.5 degree limit. And while it is geologically feasible, certainly we have technology. When it comes to economics, addressing the issue now is going to be probably more affordable than if we were to let it go and need to address the impacts and damages in the future. But these social and cultural and institutional changes that we need to really transform our energy system are, I think, the area that requires the most emphasis and also can be the hardest to move. But I don't want to underestimate the potential for rapid social change or for mechanisms like substantial changes in finance and investing to produce rapid changes in how our energy systems work and move us towards a more ambitious pathway than we're on right now.
Yes, the tone of this report is more emphatic than others I've seen in the past. Scientists call for a drastic change of course. Another new emphasis in this 2023 update, the report includes glimpses of the burden we place on coming generations, the climate debt. If we continue trying to maintain this fossil-powered life, what does that mean for our descendants?
It is important for us to think about future generations. Often the conversation stops at 2100. That's only 80 years away, less. But these changes don't stop at 2100, and future generations will be dealing with long-term impacts, and some of the changes could continue to worsen into the future. As I mentioned, sea level rise rates may increase if we're continuing to cause warming. So I think if we were to continue on this 3-degree pathway that we're on now, we would imagine a very difficult world for future generations, one in which they're experiencing what I would call global weirding, which is to say many extreme events, both extreme flood and extreme drought, devastating heat waves, and also many events starting to build up on each other or produce compounding impacts, meaning that you might be hit by a kind of devastating sort of weather or climate event, and before you can recover from that, another one has arisen. And finding that those are influencing so many places in the world that people really struggle to be able to help their neighbors. So certainly making changes now can produce rapid positive impacts, thinking about clean air, thinking about creating buildings and energy systems that are going to be more comfortable for us to live in and hopefully more just and more equitable. But there's also certainly these long-term and very important positive impacts that we can have by taking strong action now that is going to reduce risks and damages for our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, and generations to follow.
My saddest EcoShock interview was with Australian coral scientist Charlie Varon. He cataloged so many colorful corals, went diving and found them, and then watched them die in the warming oceans. Your ice world is still there, but parts of it seem to be inexorably waving goodbye. Do you and your colleagues feel the same emotions?
I would say that my colleagues and I do share those kinds of emotions that are felt by many other types of scientists who are studying portions of our Earth system, whether they be corals or wildlife, folks who are work on food security. I already in my career have seen losses from the Greenland ice sheet that are irreversible. The ice that we've lost there over the last 25 plus years is not something that we can expect to gain back. And I find that deeply saddening. I know that myself and many colleagues are really devastated by the changes that we people have allowed to happen, given that we knew about climate change for many decades now, and scientists have been sharing this information, and industry and policy and business has been aware of it for a very long time. But I also try to maintain an outlook, understanding that change is still possible, and a determination to convince as many people as possible to take really strong, bold actions, and understand that we're in a period of opportunity right now that will not remain open to us for a long time into the future. So we really need to take advantage of this time we have right now during the 2020s to take strong action before some of these vicious amplifying cycles might get out of our control. So I certainly understand all of those difficult emotions, sadness, anger, and others, but I also try to bring in determination and remind myself of all of the areas where we have made progress. Moving towards a 3-degree future is better than we were off a couple of decades ago. And many people are working on solutions and action change. And I have hope that those can continue to grow and more people can jump on board and we can see a lot of strong leadership.
From the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado, we've been speaking with scientist Twyla Moon. The State of the Cryosphere 2023 report, 2 degrees is too high, is available free from ICCINet.org, ICCINet.org. You can find links and key samples from the report in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.